Hey, everybody, it's Kai Rosdahl. Thanks for downloading this episode of the Corner Office Podcast. We're going to start today with a little history lesson. It's 1944, the Mount Washington Hotel in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. Representatives from 44 countries have met to figure out a framework for international economic cooperation after World War II. What they came up with was the International Monetary Fund. Now, what exactly the IMF does has changed a lot over the years, but it is the main agency right now focused on stability in the global economy. And that gets us to today's episode in this very different moment in international economic history. We're at the IMF headquarters in Washington, D.C. I'm talking to Christine Lagarde, the managing director of the IMF. She's been running the agency since 2011. I talked to her a couple of weeks back. We aired it on Marketplace, which is, as you know, my day job. But it was a really good conversation, and I thought we'd share a bit more of it with you. Here you go, Christine Lagarde of the IMF.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Madame Lagarde, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I don't want to start sounding trivial, but I do want to know how much time you spend and your staff explaining to people what the IMF does.
You know, I have rehearsed very carefully what is the IMF, what do we do? The IMF does three things. One, we give financial support to countries that have a balance of payment issue. In other words, they can't pay what they're buying. Mm-hmm. Number two, we give policy advice. And number three, we give technical assistance and training to countries that are trying to improve their financial management. We never, ever give grants. We always lend and we always recover the money that we have lent.
You've been at the highest levels of global economic policy for a long time now, both in France and now here at the IMF. Describe this moment for me, would you? Because it's an interesting time for multilateralism in the global economy.
You know, it's a strange moment because it's one where we still see growth. 3.5% is the forecast that we have. A small 3.5%. But we're seeing major risks on the horizon that could undermine that current growth position.
Say more on the risks you see.
The three categories of risks. Risk number one, the tensions that we are seeing in international trade, particularly between U.S. and China. Mm-hmm. The second cloud on the horizon. Second risk is the financial risks, where we are currently in a position where many countries, many corporates, many households mm-hmm. are heavily indebted in many countries in non-domestic currencies, and where we know that the financing costs will probably go up and the dollar is strong. Mm-hmm. The third risk is that of an accelerated slowdown of growth in China, which, given the size of the Chinese economy, would have an impact outside of China. And then you have some related risks, such as uncertainty of the outcome of Brexit, and that's any geopolitical risk that we have around.
Well, so to that subject of geopolitical risk, and more specifically, the role of the United States in the global economy today, you are dealing with an administration that is, if not openly hostile, then deeply skeptical of what you and this organization and the World Bank and many other multilateral institutions do. How do you deal with that as a woman whose job it is to promote multilateralism? I mean, that's your thing now, the new multilateralism.
You know, I tell you, it is not the case that the Treasury Department, with whom we have a relationship, because mm-hmm. the Treasury is representing the United States at the board of the IMF. So it is not the case that we have a bad relationship. We actually have a good relationship with the Treasury Department. I have seen, like, in the case of Egypt, in the case of Ukraine, in the case of Jordan, in the case of Argentina, significant engagement on the part of the U.S. authorities to support the work that we do in those countries.
Do you then discount the president's public position on multilateralism and institutions that work toward that goal? Because he's...
You know, I'm a very practical person. The IMF is an institution that includes 189 countries, that is both a firefighter when there is a big financial crisis and an architect when it tries to give policy advice to countries. Mm-hmm. And whether I'm labeled a multilateralist institution or not is to me irrelevant. What is relevant to me is the mission that we have to conduct, which is to maintain and help financial stability around the world, maintain and encourage prosperity. Of course, I believe myself that multilateralism is the only way to deal with threats like cyber threats, like terrorism, like pandemics, like climate change, because those issues know no borders. And you can only address them and solve them and chase the threats if we act collectively in a multilateral setting.
You know, this is interesting because you're being very positive in your outlook for multilateralism. But you wrote in a blog post, first of all, you're a blogger at the IMF website. you wrote a blog post last November called When History Rhymes. Mm-hmm. And you hearkened back to the First World War mm-hmm. and 1918 and the rise of inequality and the conflict and all of the horrible things, actually, that happened around that time. And you say, if we're not careful, we're looking at that again. Reconcile what you just said with what you wrote in November for me.
I think those threats are there. And certainly what we are seeing in many countries, predominantly advanced economies, is this sentiment that globalization, new technologies are a threat, are going to take your job, are not going to improve the future of your children, are taking you out of control of your destiny. That's what a lot of people perceive.
There are millions of people in the United States who believe that.
Yeah, no. And, you know, it's not specific to the United States.
True.
You know, movement in my country, France, like the Yellow Vest, is also an expression of this anxiety about the future. But this is not going to be solved appropriately by turning inwards, by looking at your belly button. It's going to be addressed by looking at the size of the problems, the nature of the threats, how it can be addressed, and cooperation between countries. As I said to you earlier on, terrorism, not a domestic issue. Climate change, not a domestic issue. Cyber threats, not a domestic issue. International trade, obviously international by nature. But what is domestic and what is critically important is to make sure that there is in place the protection, the adjustment mechanisms, so that people feel that they have control over their destiny. People feel that it's going to pay back for them as well, and that it's not because there is more robots, more digitalization, more artificial intelligence applied to their work site mm-hmm. and their workplace that they're going to lose out. That's where domestic policies meet international cooperation, if you will.
What do you make, then, of the trade negotiations that are happening now between China and the United States? Well, I guess, actually, do we make too much of that? Should we just bank on them being solved?
I cross my fingers every morning and my toes every evening because I hope that it is going to end up with a way to fix the system, not break it. Because I do believe that the system needs fixing. There are multiple areas that are not covered by international trade rules. There are many instances where trade is at risk of not being fair, not being mutually beneficial. There are multiple instances where the definitions are out of date and needs to be improved and changed and adjusted to the present. There has to be some realism applied to the trade relationship. And I think that is the great benefit of what is happening at the moment. So if the outcome of the discussions between the US trade team and the China trade team leads all of us in the direction of an improved framework where subsidies are well defined, where state-owned enterprises are well defined, where intellectual property is protected, where there is an encouragement to a rules-based system that provides free, fair, and mutually beneficial trade, then this is really an improvement.
grade yourself for me, would you? You've been on this job now going on 8 years, right? You got a couple of years left. How you doing so far?
You know, I might even have a third term. Why not?
Well,
not.
We'll see how this interview goes. I don't know. People are listening.
It's not for me to say.
Well,
The fact that the membership decided to reappoint me for a second term unanimously, I took that as a token of appreciation and recognition of the effort that I put in every morning and the focus that I have on delivering on the mission.
Here's a better way to ask the question, and I should have done this the first time. You came on this job in 2011. The world and certainly the American economy barely climbing out of the Great Recession. Have you been able to do what you wanted to do when you took the job?
You know, when I took the job, I was, and everybody else was, under the impression that the situation was improving significantly, yeah, and that we were out of the great financial crisis. Yeah. And then suddenly the European sovereign debt hit, right, our radar screen, and we were back into the saddle of addressing those issues and putting, you know, more programs in place in order to help countries around the world. So my job, as I said, is a bit like being a mixture of an architect helping frame policies, focusing on what is macro critical, including unusual subjects like participation of women in the workplace, reducing excessive inequalities, fighting corruptions, and being a firefighter whenever there is a crisis on the horizon and a country knocks at the door to say, I can't refinance myself, I'm in real trouble, and where I have to help.
So we are here 10 years plus or minus after the crisis. And I want to ask you about something you said early in your tenure at the IMF, that if Lehman Brothers had been Lehman Sisters, crisis either would have been different or might not have happened at all. Mm-hmm. Elaborate on that now, sitting here in 2019.
Okay, a few years later, what has changed for me is that the IMF now recognizes that the role of women in the economy can be macro critical and therefore warrants our focus, our attention, our research capacity, and our policy recommendations. What we have done very recently, I just want to mention two numbers,
sure,
for you, is a thorough study on the banking sector to see how many women were in executive boards, mm-hmm, or boards. 20% only are women. How many women are CEOs or chairmen of banks? 2%.
Yeah.
And then we tried to correlate the solidity of banks with the number of women sitting on the board. And it's very interesting to see that those banks which have a significant number of women on their board are stronger, are less likely to file for insolvency, have bigger capital buffers, have less non-performing loans, and are less risky. Interesting,
yeah,
isn't it?
No, it's totally fascinating. And I will share another anecdote with you. We have just come from an interview with Janet Yellen, former Fed chair. She said to say hi, by the way.
Reciprocated.
We're going to air that on Monday. My producer and I were chit-chatting with some of your staff before this interview. And we said, you know, it's really interesting. When you get those big group pictures of international economic meetings, you have a whole bunch of guys, and it used to be just Christine Lagarde and Janet Yellen.
It's raining men.
And you have that picture now, and it's just you.
I miss Janet.
Yeah.
I do. You know, I'm doing my best in my own capacity to encourage and support women, because I think that they are huge contributors. They can bring a lot to the table. And in this institution, for the first time, I was privileged to appoint a chief economist who is, mm-hmm, a woman.
Right, just
Gita Gopinath,
right?
Yeah. Just recently. And I will keep at it. But I think that the economic professions, particularly the macroeconomic professions, has a serious shortfall in women. And it's time that the economists actually look at it themselves. And I trust that Janet, in her position, will do that too.
We had that actual conversation about her role as president of the AEA,
yeah,
in 2020. Yeah. Well, Christine Lagarde, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Christine Lagarde, the Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund. Thanks for listening to it. You can find that Janet Yellen interview I mentioned, by the way, on our website, marketplace.org. To hear more conversations like this one, subscribe, why don't you, to the Corner Office Podcast, and leave us a review while you're there. The Corner Office Podcast is produced by Bridget Bodner. This episode by Maria Hollenhorst. Marketplace on the Radio is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the Executive Director of On Demand. Deborah Clark is the Senior Vice President and General Manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Another episode for you in a couple of weeks.